The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So when I was here talking 2 weeks ago, I touched on the topic of not-self, and there was a lot of interest for me to go into more detail on this topic, so I will today. The topic of not-self is considered by many people as a very important teaching of the Buddha. I get the sense that it might be considered more important sometimes in the modern West, and in particular countries in Asia, where there's been a stronger encounter with Western individualism, Western emphasis on the ideas of the soul, in Christianity, for example, and also in the modern kind of psychological West, which has put a tremendous amount of emphasis on the psychology of the individual. And in some ways, certain forms of psychology has actually, I think, have been beneficial in many ways, but at the same time, they've accentuated or strengthened a certain trend towards Western or United Statesian or Californian individualism. The strong sense of individualism that exists for many people here in the West has then been, the teachings of not-self have been kind of provocative and kind of maybe eye-opening or challenging or, engaging to listen to. So Buddhist teachers have often emphasized this not-self teaching. And I find myself that in the many years that I've been teaching, I teach less of it than I used to. And I find it maybe I don't find it quite as interesting as I used to find it, which I am not quite sure how to explain that. But anyway, I'll talk about it today. I'm interested enough. first thing to say that I would really want to sear into your mind so you remember is that it's a not self teaching. It is not a no-self teaching. Many people will interpret and understand that what the Buddha taught around this topic is that there is no self. And he explicitly did not teach that. In fact, when he was asked about this, or we talked about this kind of topic, he was very explicit that the teaching that there is no self is a quagmire, is a marsh, is a just kind of a quicksand to get into. And so the idea that there is no self is certainly popular. You find modern books on psychology and neuroscience. It's been a popular topic to talk about how the concept or the idea or the feeling, sense of self, is a neurophysiological construct, and it has no inherent existence, inherent thing in itself, in the way the brain functions. So it's certainly a modern idea as well, this idea of no self. But for the Buddha, it was just a philosophical quagmire to posit a no self thing, and that you'll never get out of if you go into that there. It's philosophically complex and complicated, metaphysically complex to posit such a thing. And so the Buddha wasn't interested in actually going down these metaphysical and metaphysically philosophical kind of ideas that there is no self. But he did say that he did have a teaching about not-self. And in a sense, no-self maybe is like a noun, and not-self is more like an adjective. So not-self is always used to characterize something. No-self is kind of like a blanket, broad statement that's, about the nature of human beings or reality or something. There is no-self. But not-self is always an adjective describing something or characterize something, which I'll describe or talk more about as we go on. Part of the reason to have this insight, to have an insight to perceive rather than believe the teachings of not-self, is because it can be liberating. It can liberate us from an excessive attachment to self, preoccupation with self. Preoccupation and attachment to me, myself, and mine. Selfishness and self-preoccupation, conceit, arrogance, all the whole complex things that are around this idea of self. And it isn't so much that that we're supposed to somehow believe or not believe in a self, exactly, but it's the attachment to this, the clinging to this, that it's really clinging and attachment and craving and relationship, this whole complex thing, which is the heart of what the Buddha is pointing to. And he was emphasizing that there's a way of perceiving that we see for ourselves this idea of not-self. So you can be rest assured that what I'm teaching today, you don't have to believe. That's not the point. It's not like you have to go, now you have to be a card-carrying Buddhist. You have to believe that there is no self, there is not-self, you know, that. It's just, what I'm going to talk about is, in a sense, pointing to an insight, a perception, that people who do Vipassana practice, some point, will see for themselves. And so, you know, Gil talked about that once upon a time. Wow, you know, here it is. You know, don't struggle with the whole belief thing. Okay, you know, don't believe what I'm saying, or that's not the point. It's not a belief. So to get into this topic, I think it might be useful to do it a little bit indirectly, and that is to highlight what it's like to be self-conscious as opposed to self-aware. At least in my way of using English language, being self-aware is really a wise thing, it's a useful thing, and we use mindfulness to become more self-aware. But self-consciousness has the connotations of somehow being a little bit excessively preoccupied with self, concerned with self, focused on oneself in such a way that it kind of gums up the workings of the gears inside. If you're going to do something that even something you have mastery over, and you've done it many times before, and you have to do it in front of other people, then you might get self-conscious in doing it. And in that, you trip over your own words, trip over your feet. You're not completely absorbed in doing the thing you have mastery over, because part of you is you know thinking about it. It's like one of the most famous basketball players now in America, Stephen Curry, and it's a championship game, and his team is down by 1 point, and he's about to make one of those great shots that he can make so easily. And some player or some person on the sideline, just before he's going to say it, says, "Which foot do you push off from, the right or the left?" You know, suddenly he's self-conscious. He's like, "Well, what do I do?" And or someone yells out, "Your mother's watching," or "Your high school girlfriend is watching." Suddenly, it's like, self-conscious. I'm concerned about, I better make this shot. As opposed to just making it, I have to make it, right? And so to have this self-consciousness can kind of trip people up. Sometimes it trips us up quite dramatically. People have stage fright and don't know how to speak. Or people are in social situations and they're very self-conscious about whether people think about them, whether people like them or reject them, or what's going to happen here. And so even in ordinary social situations, it can be very awkward and difficult to have a fluid conversation, or easy, because of there's so much self-consciousness involved. And so one of the that kind of self-consciousness is a kind of wind drag on our navigating through the world. It slows us down, it trips us up. And sometimes we see some people are very self-conscious. People who are extremely shy is a form of self-consciousness. And so, and sometimes you can see how it limits them and makes it awkward, and they can't quite be fluid in situations because of this self-concern, self-preoccupation, self-worry that goes on. And so, as people develop mastery, as they get more comfortable, as they feel more like people are not going to judge them, or they feel like it doesn't, they don't care as much about whether people like or don't like what they do, that they're not so wrapped up around many things, that the self-consciousness begins to drift away and fall away. Or we do certain things and we absorb ourselves in the activity. And one of the reasons why an activity that's absorbing can sometimes be relaxing and de-stressing is because of the lack of self-consciousness goes on. Part of the reason some people get exhausted through a day is not necessarily because of all the work they're doing, but rather a constant preoccupation with themselves and what they're doing. And so someone might be exhausted and then come home, and then they get themselves absorbed in a really good novel. And their mind is certainly active and busy and participating in the model, in the novel, maybe imagining it or something, but they've forgotten themselves in reading it. And so just forgetting oneself, then the self-conscious neurons are not firing. And those neurons, or I don't exactly know how it works in there, they tend to involve things like stress or contraction or tightness or, it's kind of a certain kind of exhaustion kind of thing, way of being. And so to have that not operating, muscles start relaxing, the brain settles, the energy of the brain, the agitation of the brain settles, and, it's a whole different thing. And some people can do things that are quite vigorously, takes a lot of energy to do, like exercising, and at the end of it, they feel much more relaxed and at ease. And I suspect that a good reason for that is that the ways that they're preoccupied, maybe self-preoccupied, have been put down when they're involved in those activities. So the ability to put down self-consciousness is often recognized as a source of relaxation and ease and openness. Some people find that it's quite profound to do that. There are people who will go into nature, for example, partly for that purpose. When they're involved in urban life and lots of people, it's so easy for the brain, mind, to be involved in concerns about people and where we fit and how it all works. And so much planning in the day can go into, what it's like to be a member of society. So, for example, what you wear can be done quite self-consciously. It's said that some people spend more time thinking about what they're going to wear than what they're going to say. And I wish it was the other way around. It would be easier for society, I think. But you go into the wilderness, and people go backpacking or something in nature or go down to the beach. And part of, I think some people find the value of that is that the social self, the socially interactive concerns will drop away, and it feels so peaceful not to have that operating. And it can be quite, not only peaceful, but quite inspiring, in almost a religious way or existential way. I was very touched many years ago by reading an account of, I think it was an adult woman writing it, a story of when she was a child, she went and got her hair cut, and it was an awful haircut. And so she was quite upset. And so in response, her father took her for a drive and took her somewhere up in the hills, mountainside next to where they lived, where there was a spectacular view of the natural world. And they sat there in the car looking out across the scene of nature and rolling hills or something. And the father said something like, nature doesn't care about your haircut. And that freed her. That it kind of created a different context than if the father had taken her, to the school, and they had an assembly of the whole class and the whole school and had her go up on the stage and said, notice the haircut. that would have been, probably devastating for the poor girl. But the idea of coming into the natural world and kind of resetting and re-understanding our place in society, for some people, is almost life-saving because of it's hard sometimes to get free of the self-consciousness when we're around people all the time, for some people. And so for some people, meditation is a time to settle our self-conscious mind. Just the relaxation, the settling, closing our eyes, not being part of the social world so much and the concerns. And slowly, and we keep focusing on the breathing, for example, and letting go of our thoughts. And a lot of the thoughts we might let go of are those self-conscious ones. And that can be some of the reasons why meditation can be so calming and de-stressing for people. And it could have the same value if you get calm enough as it would be that, you know, girl looking out across the natural setting. There's something, can be something about sitting, even with your eyes closed, the mind getting very still and quiet, that has the same sense of the beauty in looking at the natural world and kind of resetting a whole different existential understanding of who we are. And that's refreshing and allows people to get up from that and enter the world in a different way. And a lot of that has to do with just quieting of the mind, settling of the mind. It also has to do with the mind getting absorbed in what it's doing. And so if we're fortunate enough to be able to get concentrated, to discover the art of really kind of, or I would say it differently, discovering the value, the tremendous value of really settling on the breathing, and to value that value so much that we value it more than our self-consciousness. So we don't get pulled, we don't get so interested in all the thoughts that we're spinning in. And we really get settled and absorbed, then it can be as good, if not better, than being absorbed in a really good novel. And so the self-consciousness drops away. And then the question is, how thoroughly can self-consciousness drop away? And what value does that have to do that? One value is that it puts a question mark next to our self-consciousness. And one of the all kinds of question marks. One question mark is this self-conscious concern and preoccupation as important as it's insisting it is? You know, is it really something I need to invest in or be so concerned with? Could I just kind of, it's still operating in me, but do I really need to give it as much credence as I'm giving it? Can I just kind of step back and see it and recognize, oh, there's self-consciousness, and, you know, I can just pat it on the shoulder and say, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You can relax. Or do I have to kind of dive into it and be involved? Is it really, you can even ask deeper questions. Is it true? Is it really talking about true things and important things? And is it really, you know, necessary to be this way and think this way? So there is value to it. Highlights, not having it operate, can highlight and we see it more clearly. I would venture to say that a lot of self-consciousness, it operates semi-invisibly for people. It's just second nature so much. And part of the value of the deeper calm and stillness of meditation, it allows us to see what is often invisible because it's so, you know, it's like the fish supposedly doesn't see the water it swims in. So, but how deep can we go with this? And one of them is not just what we could consider self-preoccupation and self-consciousness, but more subtle and precise ways in which we identify with our experience. We take our experience and our things of the world and ourselves, and we see it through the framework of me, myself, and mine. So sentences that can include me, myself, and mine. And this goes on all the time. That, you know, and to some degree, it's reasonable to do it. If I get hungry, I don't pick up the fork and put it in your mouth, right? I mean, I kind of need to know where the hunger is and what direction I put the fork in order to satisfy the hunger. And I know that it's in this direction, and it's in this mouth, and. But if I say, you know, like, you know, there's grumbling and, you know, contraction and yearning for food, you know, mid-body, and it would be nice to find a fork and some food, so this appendage to this body can pick up the fork, poke the food, bring it up, you know, to the high point in this body, and where this aperture will open wide, and then stick it in, and then have those, you know, those hard teeth kind of gnaw it for a while, and then there's natural process in the throat where it swallows, and it goes down into this area where I had all this, you know, rumbling, and then it gets there's satisfaction feeling in there. How about just saying, I'm hungry, I would like to eat. I've heard lots of Buddhists, I haven't heard enough for a long time, but there was a time when excessively idealistic, especially young Buddhists, would get into this teaching that they thought that there was no self, and then avoid all personal pronouns. You know, so you ask them, how are you feeling? And they'd say, oh, there's a lot of heat. Yeah, but how are you feeling? Oh, there's heat and contraction and, you know, but how are you feeling? And they would say something similar, and you say, but you look angry. You know, so it was a very strong tendency to avoid the pronouns, and in some ways also avoid responsibility and clarity of what's going on. So that's one of the reasons, you know, to be a little bit careful with this. But there is value in being very careful in noticing the problems that arise when we identify excessively to our experience. So a classic one that meditation teachers will talk about is in the meditation hall. Like I see it right there in the middle, right smack in the middle of the floor, there's an empty zafu. I don't know why it's empty. Maybe the person decided to go to the bathroom and they're coming back. So I hope I'm not making the person self-conscious now. And so it's there, right? So, but then someone arrives late and they see an empty zafu and they sit down on it. It seems reasonable. It's not being used. And the person comes back from the bathroom and is horrified. Self-righteously, someone is sitting on my zafu. It's not my zafu. It's IMC zafu. You know, we say it is, and so then we've taken it as mine. Something that 2 hours from now it's back on its shelf, and you'll never find it again. You'll never recognize it as mine. It's temporarily mine, and a lot of heat and tension and social conflict has arisen because we've identified it as mine. Is that the best way to go through the world, to always take things as mine? And are there alternatives? The very famous story, maybe is it IMC because I like to say it, of the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, Suzuki Roshi, made a statement. While he was holding his glasses in front of him, kind of a little ahead in front of his eyes, above his nose, just holding it out with his hand. And we know this because someone took a picture just as he was saying this. So there's a picture of him doing this. And he's saying, these glasses are not my glasses. But you know about my tired old eyes, so you let me wear them. That's very different than saying, you know, these are my glasses. Kind of, you know, it's just a different way of framing it, that creates a little more space and relaxation, and, you know, it's less likely to glom onto it as mine and all that. So, you know, some of the ways in which we talk about the language we use is impactful. And using the word I, which we do a lot in English, is not an innocent word to use, even though I'd use it so many times. I was very fortunate to live in Japan for a year and lived in a Zen monastery during much of that time. Very intense situation. We slept in the same room, we ate in the same room, we were kind of always together. And so that's kind of where I learned to speak Japanese a lot. And as I was learning to speak Japanese, I started to get the vocabulary that was needed. But what I didn't know, what I knew, kind of, I learned, is in Japanese you very seldom use a pronoun. Pronouns. So very seldom use the word I. But I was trying to speak Japanese the way I spoke English. There is a way to say I in Japanese, which I had learned, and it requires four syllables. Whereas in English, it's just one. And so, so I would constantly use, and I would start sentences with this, and it's watashi wa. And so I would start, you know, all my sentences, you know, watashi wa. And it got so painful for me to listen to myself because it was so out of context in that Japanese culture to keep referring back to yourself that way, I. And now I've become, because of that experience, I became much more self-conscious or self-aware about how often in English we use the word I. And what I'd like to propose is it's seldom an innocent word to use. The word I is a magnet for unconscious, subconscious, and conscious ideas of what it means to be a self. And we have, all of us will have ideas of what it means to be a human being, a self, a being in society, that are learned from our society, from our family, from our life experience, and from, you know, maybe even from our own personality. And so when we use the word I, we might use it seemingly innocently, but it comes along with a lot of baggage. So for people coming from an individualistic culture, like some people do in the United States, there are kind of all these ideas of what it means to be an I. And you listen to that through some of the little sayings that are maybe repeated. You know, think for yourself. Stand on your own two feet. Be your own person. What are other little sentences like that that you can think of that you hear that emphasize the self and take care of yourself, maybe, or be true to yourself.
Stand your ground.
Stand up for yourself. Sorry?
Find
your true north. North? Yeah. Find your true north. Find your thing, you know. You know, find yourself. Be yourself. You know, all kinds of things. So, you know, that's maybe, you know, in some ways it's okay to do that. In some ways it's appropriate with a culture that has organized itself around individualism. You know, that follows. It's okay to some degree. There's other possibilities. There's societies that organize themselves collectively as cultures, and as communities or as groups and collective cultures, and they have different sayings. And for some of them, coming to like an individualistic culture, it's quite grating and difficult. I've known people who came from Japan and put their kids in first grade, and were horrified at what the kids were expected to do. I remember one family saying that they came there, and when the kid's birthday, if it happened during the school year, they were supposed to make a collage, a poster, about all the ways in which they were a special person. And this goes against the grain in traditional Japanese culture. They highlight yourself, stand out. One of the sayings they have comes out of Confucian culture, which is Japanese culture is part of it, is that the nail that stands up will be hammered down. So meaning that if you stand out, especially in any kind of way, that somehow they're out of harmony with anyone and you'll be pushed down. So in collectivist cultures, I'm not so familiar with it, but they have their own sayings. And they're more like, rather than think for yourself, what does the elders want, or what's right for the family or the community? Thinking for yourself is not so important because you're supposed to kind of fit in. I saw when I was in the monastery in Japan, I saw a Japanese man who was ostracized by the other monks. And I said, why is he being ostracized? And I was told, because he's thinking for himself. You know, because it was so much against the grain of what was expected in that kind of collective society. So to be a self there is to be part of a community, a group, and figuring out how to harmonize with a group and work together with a group is you know, how that society is organized. It's not worse or better, either, any of these. It's just different ways that groups have to be organized. You have to be organized some way. And this is choices, and they have their pluses and minuses and different ones. And those of us who live in the modern West can feel acutely sometimes the shortcomings of the individualism. For people who come from a collectivist culture, they sometimes can see, it's obvious, some of the limitations of an individualistic culture, but also they find the liberation that comes from it as well. Some people come from collectivist culture find a breath of fresh air coming to the United States. So the idea that when you use the word self, it's not so innocent. It comes along with these kind of ideas we have and understandings we have that come along. So it can be as simple as, you say that, it's my clothes. You look in your closet, it's my clothes. That's nice. People will sometimes wear clothes in order to have the clothes represent what they want people to see them as or who they believe they are. And so people wear clothes that, because I'm beautiful, I should wear, you know, prove it with my clothes. Or I'm a professional, and I want to show people, so wear my professional clothes. Or I'm an athlete, and so or an outdoors person, so I wear clothes that are more outdoorsy. Or, you know, when I first came to San Francisco Zen Center, there was a uniform that a lot of the Zen students were wearing, so people know that they were Zen students. They were fat pants, Danish school bags, and Amish vests, and I think Birkenstocks. And so all these people were going around, you know, and that was the uniform for a while. And maybe some of you have. And then if you pack your clothes away, you know, put it in a box, it's no longer in fashion or something, and you find it 20 years later, and you lift it up, and it's hard to kind of, you know, feel identified. Oh, I used to be that person or present myself that person, and now, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm not that anymore. And so my clothes is a magnet for what we're trying to prove or show ourselves or be as a self for some people. My opinions, you know, we all have some opinions, but is a magnet for what it means to be seen by people, known by people, an identity I want to have that I want to prove. And so there's a lot of attachments, a lot of things that come along with having an opinion. That's not just having the opinion. And of course, you know, it's maybe sometimes most obvious when other people have opinions, you know, and they're coming on really strong and all that. And when we do vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, sometimes there's a technique where we change how we, in our minds, how we talk about ourselves. So, for example, if you're fairly settled and calm, and can really be sensitive, you know, to feel or sense the differences of things. If you have knee pain, and you say to yourself, "My pain," and then say to yourself, "The pain," some people will feel the difference. Because of my pain, it's a magnet for different kind of preoccupation, contraction. This is more important. This says something about me. And so it can make a very subtle difference in the pain, actually. And some people, when they say "the pain" or see it through that lens, it makes more space, there's more relaxation, there's less weight on it, or less that, you know, less just philosophically or, you know, psychologically, less that's involved. It's just the pain. And so to start seeing it, that it's actually easier and simpler to call it "the something" rather than "mine." So if you're angry, humans get angry. If you say "my anger" or "I am angry," it's all too easy for that not to be an innocent statement or innocent, simple statement about there being anger. I'm angry, and suddenly I'm a wrong person for being angry. I'm embarrassed for being angry. I shouldn't be angry. I hope no one sees me as anger. It gets kind of much more complicated around the whole idea of identity and representation and how we should be and how we shouldn't be as a person. But if we can just relax and see it as the anger, it might be easier. Except when you're in these conversations with, you know, oh, there's heat and contraction. Sometimes you just do people a favor and tell them you're angry. And say, "I'm angry." If you say "the anger," I've seen people also not take responsibility for their emotions by saying the all the time. But in deep meditation, it's a great place to switch from saying "my" or "I" to "the." So "the anger." And to not make it any more complicated, there's the presence of anger here. I don't need to identify with it. I don't have to use the anger to represent who I am. I don't have to see myself through the lens that I'm a person who is angry. It can just be anger that floats up. And it's a remarkable thing to watch something like anger just float up. Occasionally, you might, if you're really subtle in meditation, there's nothing sticky in the mind, you can see anger arise, and it just kind of, like the mind is Teflon, it just arises and goes. And And it's no self involved. Just, you know, there's no I. Just anger. Hi, is it, you say as it goes by. I had interpersonally an experience of this. Was formative for me when I was in the Zen monastery at Tassajara. I was the kitchen manager, supervising a lot of the people working in the kitchen. And it was a hard job, and so sometimes, you know, being in charge of a group of people can be socially complex. It was a job where I learned how neurotically I was concerned about wanting everyone to like me. And so that's a topic of self, right, today. And it became the mental gymnastics that I tried to do to make everyone like me. You know, it's impossible to make everyone like you, I'm sorry to say. So if you live based on that idea, you're in trouble. So I did that. So that's where I saw it. But remember, I was managing. I told something to someone, an older man, meaning that he was already wise to the world. And he turned towards me, and he directed at me this white anger. And he just said, "Don't ever do that again." And as soon as he finished saying that, his anger was completely gone. I had never experienced someone who had that clean anger and was no more. I got the message, and there was nothing, no trace, no residue. There was no nothing after that. Wow, that was impressive. And I got the message. But if he had been self-conscious, I'm angry, and, you know, and self-righteous about his anger, I bet it would have lingered for him for a long time. And maybe we would have had the lingering challenges in our relationship. But, he didn't maybe identify with it in this that way. So the anger. So we find in meditation that it becomes easier and easier, more relaxed and more simple, to not add I, me, myself. Or to say it more differently, that we don't have to interpret our experience through the lens of me, myself, and mine. So emotions arise, it's just an emotion. A thought arises, it's a thought. Sensations in the body, even pain arises, it's sensations, it's pain, and just they are simple. And, you know, it might seem innocent enough to call it mine and I, but it also feels that, why bother? It involves a little bit more complex operation or more complicated operation of the brain neurons to kind of say I, and the mind is a little more agitated to use that kind of concept, and just to have it be very simple is just very refreshing and easeful and a lot less self-consciousness, and it can feel so good to do this. What happens as the I, me, myself, and I, and the ideas and concepts and thinking quiets down, we stop projecting onto our experience our ideas, our concepts and ideas. And one of the things we start seeing, one of the things that ideas and concepts that are projected tend to do, it tends to reify reality. It tends to camouflage or hide how things are constantly in flux and changing and moving. And it's fascinating in meditation to watch how when I'm involved in my thinking, I've lost touch with a changing flow of sensations and experience of the moment. Wow, look at that. It's like camouflaged, or it's like I've turned on the radio and I can't hear anything else. And then you turn the radio off and you can hear the birds outside or something. And so to watch that kind of tipping back and forth, and to just be with the direct experience without the ideas, and then to see how satisfying it is not to have the ideas and concepts of me, myself, and mine, lends itself to starting having this insight into not-self. So, some people will are very self-conscious about their fingernails. Sometimes I see how many fingernail salons there are in Redwood City. I've never noticed it before. There are so many. It must be a Redwood City thing. And I don't know what it costs to go in there, but they look kind of expensive to me. And so there's a lot of money is spent on fingernails, and people, when they spend a lot of money and time on them, there must be a lot of selfing involved, me, myself, and mine, and my fingernails, and all that. But then, you know, they get a little bit too long, and so the ends of them are clipped off, and they're the clipped off pieces are laying there someplace, and, you know, yep, that's me. You know, I better, you know, put those on a silver platter so I can show my friends, you know. I better, you know, show off my beautiful, expensive fingernail clippings and so people know who I really am. You know, frame them, you know. We just throw them away. Some people, I know, put them in the toilet, some people in the trash, some people throw them into the garden, in the compost, you know. And then they long forget about them. It's they're no longer me, you know. And So then the question is, are these things, our fingernails, our hair, our nose, our lips, our emotions and feelings, our opinions, our possessions, are they somehow inherently who I am? And so the not self-teaching is a recognition that the things that we experience, the particular things that we touch and see, and this I want to underscore this important word, the particular things, we want to get away from generalities, broad concepts of things, but the things that we can actually touch and see and smell and experience, and you know, in a very clear way, individual thoughts, the thinking itself. It can be very obvious that in and of themselves, they themselves are not the self. They don't qualify as the self. So certainly the fingernail clippings are not the self, but, you know, your fingernails too are not the self. Your little, you know, finger is not the self. The little itch that you have on your forearm is not yourself. The particular thought that you might have, it's possible to see a thought arise and say, you know, I don't know what that is. It's not me, it's just a thought arises. How many times does a thought arise in daily life because something happened around you that stimulated something, a thought that, the mind just thinks on its own. It's not me thinking, I'm not self-consciously thinking, intentionally thinking and all that. It's just a thought arises. My wife had medically induced menopause when she was in her mid-30s, temporary, for a medical condition. And remember she said, I'm having these thoughts which are not my thoughts. And I thought that, you know, that was kind of a wise thing. Probably more people who have menopause would be good too. Helpful to kind of say, these not my thoughts. It's just thoughts are happening. It's not like not happening in this mind, but it is glomming on, all the extra baggage we have around self. And so, when you look at anything in particular, the adjective that describes it is not self. You know, it's a not self, or this, the not self thought, the not self feeling, the not self emotion, the not self sound. And so you start seeing that everything that's particular in our experience, every possible particularity that we can actually experience, in that particularity, that is not a self in that, not found there. Does that mean that there is no self? The Buddha said, don't go there. Don't bother with that kind of question. Just that the particularity is there's not self. Is there then a general sense, a generalized concept of self? Then sometimes it's useful, you know, to say that, you know. I need to go to the bathroom. I need to end this talk. You know, so that's kind of, you know, it's okay to say that. And so, this idea of, you know, it's a useful concept, but it's a world of difference between using concepts of me, myself, and mine as useful concepts that we use when they're useful, and we're quite cognizant of that their constructs, their ideas, their ways of organizing our experience, as opposed to using it where it's a magnet for all the heavy baggage, our concepts, ideas that come along with our culture, our experience, our family, all kinds of things, or what it means to be a self. And so it frees us from a lot of self-consciousness, it frees us from a lot of attachments and a lot of clinging that has to do with self. It's a fascinating world to step into this not-self world. You haven't changed at all. You're still the same person you always were. And you might still use the word I and me and myself just as much as you did before. But when you have a deep enough experience of not-self and let go of the attachment to self that can exist, then it's in a wonderful way that this metaphor is not going to convey. It's kind of like two things can coexist. Like you're looking at the movie in the screen and you're completely aware that these are actors acting it out. It's not really happening. And you're enjoying the movie. So you can really clear that you're using the word self and it's useful, but it's, you know, kind of, it's provisional. It's kind of like the actor. And so you see both, and so you use it when it's useful, but you're ready to drop it when it's not. So not self. So the Buddha's teachings are not self. So I hope that you appreciate that this teaching of not self, its function is not to believe in not self. Its function is to help us liberate, be freed from excessive attachment, preoccupation with self. So may you be liberated from all self-consciousness while you're happily self-aware. Thank you. So everyone's welcome to stay.